Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Low-flying jumbo jet with fighters over New York City?
Okay, Interceptor 1 to File Photo 1, we need you to descend to 2,000 feet and make left toward the Statue of Liberty. Over.
Roger, you want us to buzz Lady Liberty, Interceptor 1?
Negative. File Photo 1, we're just looking for a file photo with the statue.
Roger that. What about those crowds of screaming people running out of all the buildings there in Lower Manhattan? Are they going to ruin the shot? Over.
Negative. We'll just Photoshop them out.
Roger that.
Now, File Photo 1, when you come around, we're going to take this picture, so smile for the camera.
Roger that.
And don't hit any buildings. Over.
Roger that.
Very nice, File Photo 1. You're looking good. I think we'll send one of these beauties to Mayor Bloomberg.
Without the crowds, Interceptor 1?
Roger that.
Okay.
Love it. We got that to worry about. Low planes over Manhattan with everything else on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, April 28th, our first birthday here at The Takeaway. Congratulations. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, we're going to check in with an epidemiologist to find out what we know about swine flu this morning. We'll also talk about the depiction of minorities as heroes in pop culture. Right now, Disney is promoting its first African-American princess character. And the economic crisis can stress kids out, too. We're going to talk with a grief counselor who's created an online journal to help them through it. Those stories, but first, these headlines. The World Health Organization says it suspects people with swine flu in the U.S. may have transmitted the virus to others here. That would indicate it's spreading beyond those travelers returning from Mexico. Spokesman for the organization, Gregory Hartle, says so far there's been no reason to raise the global flu alert to the highest level, phase 6.
We are still at phase 4 because we do not have incontrovertible evidence that this is an efficient spreader. It might turn out not to be.
Phase 4 means there is sustained human-to-human transmission of the virus. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says it's still too early to say how things will develop.
We do not yet know how widespread this flu will be within the United States, so we continue to move aggressively to prepare.
Well, what do we know? Femi Oke is here to help me out. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there, John. With the swine flu on everybody's minds, the Senate is on the verge of finally confirming the country's next Secretary of Health and Human Services. A vote on the nomination of Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius is anticipated this afternoon. After debate this morning, she is expected to be confirmed. In international news, Pakistan says that it's expanding the fight against the Taliban. The Pakistani military says that fighter jets are attacking military hideouts in a district near Islamabad, and ground troops are preparing to enter the Bunair district, which is close to the Swat Valley.
Thank you, Fem. So did you see the pictures of that jumbo jet flying
over
Manhattan?
I heard the story.
Crazy.
I didn't see the pictures.
Completely insane. So
right.
The Dow finished flat yesterday, finishing at 80.25. The S&P begins trading at 8.58. Tell us your confidence in government. That's what we're focusing on in this swine flu outbreak controversy. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
So good morning, everyone. The latest on the swine flu outbreaks around the world here in the United States, 50 confirmed cases, 152 deaths in Mexico. The tip of the spear of trust, or at least government information on issues like this here in the United States, is Tom Skinner, spokesperson for the Centers for Disease Control, who began our program yesterday, and he joins us once again. Tom, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
How much trust do you think people have in the CDC as you get ready for another day of, I suspect, pretty hectic evaluating of information coming in from all sides?
Well, I hope they have a lot of trust in what we're saying. It's very important that they be informed. You know, the best antidote for fear really is information. And so we really do want people to be informed about what's going on and know that there really are steps that they can take to protect themselves and others.
Now, I don't want to put you on the spot too much here, Tom. I know you're on your way into the office, but can I run down some numbers with you? We've got 152 deaths, all of them in Mexico, and none of them anywhere else. Does that surprise you at all?
You know, this is an evolving situation, and I think the longer this goes on, we're going to learn more about cases in the United States. And thankfully, all the cases in our country have recovered. We haven't had any deaths, but we're still talking about a relatively small number of cases. And so we would expect to see some more cases here, more severe cases, and possibly some deaths. But we still want people to know that, you know, there really are steps that they can take to protect themselves and to take those steps to protect themselves and others and try to limit the impact this has on public health.
Exactly 24 hours ago, we were looking at 20 cases in the United States. It more than doubled. We've got 50 confirmed cases. Would you expect that to double again today, or is this going to settle down?
We should know by, you know, later this morning how many cases we're seeing. We do expect more from possibly some more states, but we'll have more information later this morning.
Do you expect, we've got a cluster in New York at one New York City school, 28 cases. Any sign of clusters or are these individual incidences as far as you can tell?
They're both. We do have some clusters going on, but they're primarily sporadic cases coming in from various states as our surveillance, our enhanced surveillance picks up these cases.
All right, Tom Skinner, thanks so much. Spokesperson for the Centers for Disease Control. We will wish you good luck today, and we'll speak with you tomorrow if possible.
Okay, thank you.
Tom Skinner, spokesperson for the Centers for Disease Control. Now, from Mexico City, Joan Griot joins us. He's Mexico correspondent for Time magazine and was talking yesterday about how significantly gripped Mexico City was by the pronouncements coming out of the government. A lot of public events were canceled yesterday. What's it look like this morning, Joan?
It's more of the same picture, more and worse. I mean, we've had the schools shut down across Mexico City for 3 or 4 days. Now they shut down the schools in the entire country. So it's every school and university across the whole of Mexico has been given a holiday. And then you were talking about trust. There's still the issue of trust here. People are worried and tense and suspicious, but some are also suspicious about their own government and wondering if their government is handling this crisis well or if it's making some wrong moves. There's been some interesting information about the origins of the flu and the way the government handled that. I don't know if you've seen that information.
Let me know. I mean, we do know that it began, or at least the suspicion is that it began at an agricultural center where there was, fairly large-scale production of pigs, right?
That's correct. I mean, originally they were talking just a couple of days ago about the first case being a woman on April 12th. Who died of this virus in the southern state of Oaxaca. But then yesterday at a news conference, the health secretary conceded that that wasn't the first case. They actually found as early as February, there was a flu outbreak in the eastern Gulf of Mexico state of Veracruz. And that they finally confirmed from a sample of a four-year-old boy who suffered from influenza in that outbreak near a pig farm, that he had the swine flu virus. Now, the health minister was asked, and again, the issue of trust comes up here. They asked him, why wasn't there more done by the government back then? And his answer was, well, this is a new virus, a new phenomenon in the world, and we really didn't know it was happening.
Wow. Well, that's interesting, and it will definitely affect the way people proceed in following government instructions about closing events and maintaining, limited contact if they expect to contain things. And, of course, the World Health Organization says that we're past the point of containment. Joan Griot, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Dr. Michael Edmonds, an epidemiologist at Virginia Commonwealth University. Let's begin, Doctor, right there. The World Health Organization says we're beyond containment. The Mexican government concedes this has been going on since February. What does that say to you as an epidemiologist?
Well, it sounds as though the outbreak continues to grow. And I think we have to continue to educate the public about what things they may do to protect themselves.
And in the United States, you know, we're talking about trust in Mexico. We're talking about trust in the United States, actually wondering if our listeners can tell us what they think about what the U.S. is doing. How do you rate the responses of the government so far?
Well, I think it's been quite good. I think they've tried to get information out to the public and doing it in a way in which they give information but not create alarm. I think they've done a pretty good job of that.
Now, if this actually began in February, what's the chance that the virus that we're dealing with now is actually a mutated virus from the one that was responsible for the first outbreaks back in February?
Well, that's possible. I think one of the things that we know about influenza is that over time it continues to change. It can change in small ways that we call shift or drift if it's larger in terms of the changes that it makes. And because it's ever-changing, it's always a virus in which we seem to be chasing it.
We seem to be chasing. What does that mean exactly?
Well, for example, even from year to year, we're never certain about which strains may be circulating to the greatest degrees in the community. And that's why you'll see in some years the strains that are in the influenza vaccine don't match the strains that are circulating in the community. And in effect, we don't get a good response from the vaccine.
Well, Dr. Richard Besser, who's acting director of the Centers for Disease Control, addressed that point directly at a news conference yesterday afternoon. Take a listen to this.
It's hard to know what the course of an outbreak is going to look like until you're much further into it. Another thing that's important to note is that we're nearing the end of flu season. And often in outbreaks of influenza, you'll see a decline in the number of cases because it's the end of flu season. And we can't rest too comfortably on that because sometimes those come back again in the fall when flu season comes back.
So, Dr. Edmonds, is the season and the weather working against the proliferation of this virus, but that it is likely to remain dormant until next fall?
Well, that's typically what happens. As we move into spring, you start to see fewer cases of the flu. And as you probably know, the flu seasons are opposite in the opposite hemispheres. So this time of the year in the northern hemisphere, we would tend to see flu cases go away.
Now, no one has explained to me why there would be 152 deaths in Mexico and no deaths anywhere else. Is that possible?
Well, it's happened, so yes, it's possible. But why we
but let me just say, do we really know that? In other words, is this a reporting issue? Is this a reporting error? Are there deaths out there we might not know about, or is it actually conceivable that there would be only deaths in one location?
Well, I think the answer to that is there's probably some truth to both things of what you said. We probably don't know of all the deaths. We probably don't know of all the cases even. But I think there probably is a kernel of truth in the fact that there was a much higher mortality rate in Mexico than that we've seen in the United States to this point. But that could change.
Back in the 70s, we had a swine flu scare, and the government urged people to get vaccines, and it didn't turn out very well. Is there any lesson from the period in the 70s?
I think the lesson about this particular virus, influenza, is that it's always unpredictable.
But does that mean that you should get a shot, that if there is an antiviral therapy, that you should proceed aggressively against that, or should you just hope for the best?
No, I think flu shots are really valuable, and people should avail themselves of them.
And what's the time frame on development of a vaccine? We're sort of at the initial stages now, and the current seasonal flu virus isn't going to help us.
I think that at the earliest, it would be months.
Months. Dr. Michael Edmonds, epidemiologist at Virginia Commonwealth University, thanks for helping us out with that.
Thank you.
So some numbers just to reconfirm: 152 deaths, all of them in Mexico, 50 confirmed cases of swine flu here in the United States. How much do you trust your government? That's the question for you, either about the information they're giving you or the suggestions they have for keeping you healthy, preventative suggestions, as swine flu appears to proliferate. Here on The Takeaway. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Continuing now with more information about the swine flu outbreaks around the world. As the confirmed number of cases of swine flu continue to rise, countries are responding at their borders, some tightening transport and immigration controls, some maybe taking a more loose response. Here's Janet Napolitano speaking on NBC earlier this morning, talking about how that relates to the U.S. and Mexico.
That would be a very, very heavy cost for, as the epidemiologists tell us, would be marginal, if any, utility in terms of actually preventing the spread of the virus.
So for some geography and biology, we turn to BBC science reporter Matt McGrath, who's watching the situation of the swine flu spread across the world from our partners, the BBC in London. And I asked him if the patterns in the spread of the swine flu are some indication of the challenges involved in coming up with a uniform response from different countries that find themselves simultaneously affected by this outbreak.
It's very difficult to say at this time because this is still a very fluid situation. We've had the World Health Organization last night saying they were upping the level of concern from 3 to 4, meaning that they see sustained transmission from one human to another. And they were saying that it is a very fluid situation, and they were saying that containment was not the way to go, which means basically closing borders and trying to stop people traveling, in their view, was not the best policy. Their view on the best policy was simply to try and mitigate it, which means to treat people if they get sick, to stop people getting sick and spreading it in their own countries. They say that globally, you know, containment is not where we're at right now.
Well, I want to talk about containment in a moment, but scientifically, is uniformity of response really the best plan in a situation like this? Everybody gets the same antivirals. Everybody has access to the same sort of, health treatments. Everybody has the same diagnostic tools.
That would be great in an ideal world, but we don't live in an ideal world. In different countries, a different level of preparedness by a long way. I mean, the situation in some respects has been exacerbated perhaps by the response in Mexico to the outbreak, not having lab facilities to do the testing, having to send the samples to the United States and to Canada to get them confirmed. You look at a place like Hong Kong, which has outbreaks of SARS and other diseases in the past, and how prepared they are. They have 6 labs on standby. They've got 1,400 beds ready for people to go into them. They've got a database of people who can deal with this sort of thing. There's different levels of preparedness depending, I guess, on experience that people have had with diseases in the past. And this is one of the things that's brought out. You know, we are different and we have different responses. The WHO and other organizations try to make that better by lending their expertise. But there's no doubt there's going to be different responses in different places.
So, Matt, talk to us about the incubation period, as far as we know it, of this virus. A lot of the responses, the government suggestions to people involve either staying away from other people during this period of incubation, and that somehow affects the infection rate. Explain.
There's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how long this is incubated for and the level of virulence of this particular strain. There's one school of thought that feels that the number of people who died in Mexico is based on the fact that this virus is extremely virulent and has killed its host, if you like, killed the people that were carrying it very quickly and therefore limited its spread, and that it may have mutated in some respects, become a little bit milder, and that's why it's spreading more evenly amongst people and more quickly. The issues of incubation and the issues of when the best time to get treatment to people, again, we're getting kind of conflicting signals from different countries at different times. We've had ministers here in the UK saying, you know, 5 days is, wait 5 days and see what happens to you. You've had other people saying, well, you know, you've got to get those drugs into people in the first 48 hours because that's the crucial time when they have the most benefit. We're getting a little bit of mixed signals at the moment, and I think it's based on the fact that we don't know enough about the virus. We don't know enough about its particular abilities, its particular virulence, its particular strengths.
Well, let's talk about that term virulence. Now, let's be precise, because I think it's really important to be precise with language. When you say virulence, are you talking about some sort of toxicity of the virus or its tendency to propagate quickly and sort of overwhelm the host?
It's more about its ability to actually to kill people. I mean, that is one of the key things here. And we don't know enough about it yet to be able to say whether this is, because we have the big mystery here really is obviously the fact that lots of people in Mexico have died and people in other parts of the world have become sick, but nobody has yet died. And we're trying to understand and explain why that's going on. And part of that very much is this view that the virulence may have changed as the virus moved from Mexico, the epicenter, if you like, of the outbreak, into people who have just visited Mexico. Because at this moment in time, we haven't had people who have contracted it from people who've been to Mexico. Everybody's had a direct connection to Mexico. So we're still assessing the level of virulence, the level of threat that this particular virus poses.
The fact that we know about the epicenter, and it's even been traced to perhaps some incidences near a pig farm in February, according to the latest information out of Mexico, does that help us to understand what the actual scientific makeup of this virus is, as far as we know at this point?
Very much. I think that's the key thing here, is establishing where the outbreak took place, how it transmitted to people, and who do those people get in contact with. You know, this particular place in Mexico that we're talking about, where this pig facility was, and there was an outbreak amongst the local people shortly afterward, where several hundred people were infected in a very short period of time. That has to be nailed down, because that, you know, sometimes people get the wrong idea that it may not necessarily have come from the pig facility. It may have come from another source. The scientists need to get in there, to do the test. They need to do the basic finger printing work, basically, to try and track this virus to its real origin. And that will give them clearer view as how we should take forward the response.
How long do you think it will take governments to learn and researchers to learn whether this has the potential for being a truly airborne transmission virus, or it's something that will require fairly intensive contact to transmit?
I think we already know that it's transmitted person to person via the normal routes of flu and colds, which are pretty simple, and that the virus can, you know, survive on surfaces like phones or, you know, doorknobs for a couple of hours or possibly longer. We know things like that about flu viruses, so there will be that level of knowledge in the scientific community anyway. But it will take probably another week, another 5 to 7 days, to really establish the origins and the level of threat that this particular virus poses. Because at this moment in time, you know, you have more confirmed cases in the United States than you do in Mexico, where you've had 150 deaths. And that's obviously a problem of the laboratories and a problem of the science and a problem of an understanding. At this moment in time, samples are being shipped from the United States and from Mexico to other parts of the world, to other labs. Some are due to arrive here in the UK tomorrow, at which point the scientists here will be able to get their first look at what's really happening. And so then you'll have a greater knowledge amongst the scientists out in the world who will be able to put together a better picture. So I'm thinking that over the next week at the utmost, possibly in the next 2 to 3 days, we'll get a clearer view of where this virus is going.
Giving us a global perspective on the swine flu outbreak, that was BBC Science reporter Matt McGrath, who joined us from London a little earlier this morning. Femi Oke has some headlines now.
Thank you very much. The Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says that it's still too early to see how the flu outbreak will develop in the United States. And the number of confined swine flu cases in the US has doubled in the last 24 hours to 50 cases. The Senate votes today on the nominee for Health and Human Services Secretary. Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius is due to be confirmed. The top 20 positions at the Health and Human Services Department are currently vacant or held by acting personnel. And that is a look at the top stories for this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The outbreak of swine flu has a lot of people worried and a lot of people with questions, too, and it all relates to trust in your government. We want to know, are you hearing what you need from the government, and do you have trust in your government telling you what you need to know about swine flu?
This is Rick Call from New York. And regarding your question, I quote Mark Twain, "With truth in such scarcity, no one ever seems in any rush to find it."
Well, what do you think? Quotes about truth or your own sense of truth or your trust in your government? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So we're going to have one of these conversations that we love to have periodically here on The Takeaway, and we have been on for a year now. And, you know, one of the things we like to talk about is, you know, how pop culture is actually deep in the culture, is way more than simply box office or movie titles. Comic books, for instance, have always been a place to concoct new identities, to extend the possibilities of humans, whether it be leaping tall buildings or exploring one's Wolverine side in X-Men or gender in Mulan.
Okay, how about this?
Excuse me, where do I sign in? I see you have a sword. I have one too. They're very manly and tough.
I'm working on it. Oh, who am I fooling? It's going to take a miracle to get me into the army.
One tough Mulan got into the army. This idea of playing around with gender in animated and comic books and other sort of graphic novels, ethnicity and other sorts of human traits. Comic books are kind of a laboratory, and it motivated us to ask Jeff Yang, who's the editor of the new book Secret Identities, the Asian American Superhero Anthology. He's also the author of the Asian Pop Column at the sfgate.com website, among other things. Jeff, thanks so much for coming into the studio. This Secret Identities book is really a laboratory for Asian Americans to explore all kinds of identity issues, to really get beyond ethnicity. Do you think of comic books as a laboratory for exploring identity beyond ethnicity and gender?
Yeah, actually, you know, one of my co-editors, Parry Shen, actually calls comic books in some ways a way of almost doing a blockbuster movie with no budget. I mean, you can have a anything happen, literally, any kind of special effects, any kind of transformations you want without the limitations we have on budget.
And limitations you have on casting. I mean, non-traditional casting is sort of the point of comic books, even though traditionally comic books have been sort of all white characters, and the real difference has been how depressed they were. Some were smiling, some were kind of troubled. But now you're really seeing a proliferation of characters. Describe.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting because over just the last decade or so, there really has been an attempt to make this fantastic world of the comic book look a little bit more like our reality, you know, to inject a diverse set of experiences and backgrounds and identities, literally, into the costumed characters that we know and love.
I sense, though, and Mulan is one example, even though she's ostensibly Asian, she's also a kind of a unigender, uni-ethnicity. That there's maybe it's the Disney Corporation coming up with that on their own, but I see in comic books a youth culture attempting to kind of get beyond traditional categories.
Yeah, you know, I think that's true in a sense. I mean, I think that there's a need, obviously, for people, you know, at the corporate level, certainly, to broaden their audience as much as possible. I mean, you can't have even in this world of micro-targeting, you still need mass culture. And as a result, it's not necessarily about saying, we're going to create a character who's Asian American, who speaks only to Asian Americans, but more, let's take a story, Asian or otherwise, and make it as broadly available and accessible and interesting as possible to people of all backgrounds.
Is that why a filmmaker like Miyazaki works universally? Just change the voices?
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely truth in that. I mean, you know, Hayao Miyazaki is, of course, one of the greats of anime. And his power is that he tells universal stories, but he tells them from a cultural position that's really unique. And I think it's that uniqueness in some ways which brings richness and vibrancy to the stories. If it was sort of generically flattened to begin with, I don't think it would be as interesting.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's a combination of universality in some sort of narrative sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to be curious. You've got to take people to a different world.
I think it's absolutely right. And, you know, me and my co-editors and, you know, Jerry Ma, Keith Chow are the other two. You know, one of the things that we actually have experienced, you know, growing up, obviously, as Asian Americans is that...
Well, it's not obvious, actually, well, because you're on the radio.
This is true.
It's obvious to me.
Do I sound Asian American?
Radio is non-ethnic.
No, it's true. But, you know, the fact is mass culture, radio and otherwise, yeah. You know, it doesn't really reflect our experiences very deeply. And yet, you know, when you look at something like comic books and animation, you see a world where, like you said, anything can happen. And the question is, why doesn't it? You know, it's not even so much an issue of whether or not people can be black or yellow or red or whatever. But in comic books, people can be green.
Right. And often are.
And yes,
so introduce me to some superheroes from this collection here that I need to know, who have traits that I actually need to embody.
Well, you know, one of the things we try to do is make stories that were in and of themselves, you know, as we were discussing, universal. There is a story called 9066, which we launched, we sort of opened the book with almost, which is about the first Asian American superhero to really kind of come out as a superhero. And he's Japanese American, and it's during World War II. So, of course, one of the first things he encounters is the difference between wearing a mask and fighting crime and being seen as who he is, as his ethnicity during World War II.
And so his ethnicity is kind of a mask, in a
sense. It is.
Wow.
And that's actually one of the big reasons we used this notion of the lens of the superhero to look at culture, because the notion of having a secret identity is very much a part of the Asian American experience, of having a part of yourself people can't see.
Well, empowering us all to be sort of a Dora the Explorer of comic book heroes, Jeff Yang writes the Asian pop column for sfgate.com. He's the author of several books, including Once Upon a Time in China, a guide to the cinemas of Hong Kong, Taiwan, and mainland China. Jeff Yang, thanks so much for coming in. And
yes.
Yay, Dora. You're kind of our Dora the Explorer.
I do my best, rooting around the news world for you this morning at 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The Supreme Court hears arguments today on whether states have the right to investigate banks for racial discrimination in lending. New York wants to overturn a court decision that blocks the state from investigating lending practices. The federal government argues only it has the right to conduct that type of financial oversight. Barack Obama's presidency seems to be shifting public perceptions of race in the United States. That's according to a new poll from the New York Times and CBS News. Two-thirds of Americans now say that race relations are generally good, and the percentage of African Americans who say so has doubled since last July. Swine flu has now spread to Asia and the Middle East, with new cases confirmed in New Zealand and Israel. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano told NBC's Today Show that Americans should stay calm.
We anticipate that there will be confirmed cases in more states as we go through the coming days. And I think the feeling ought to be that of preparation, not fear.
The CDC is asking people not to kiss when greeting and to wash hands regularly to try to block the spread of the virus. And some more details on Chrysler's deal with the UAW. Under the new deal, the union will own 55% of Chrysler after it's restructured, and the union's retiree healthcare trust will get a seat on the board. That's looking at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. You know, a year ago when we went on the air, we were looking not for economic indicators, we were looking for political indicators.
I think Obama kind of stands out to young people because he's won a Grammy Award and for his music and stuff.
That was the very talented PJ, the very opinionated PJ, who was a student in the fifth grade class in Iron Forge Elementary School in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, and the student of Janet Kunkel, who taught fifth grade last year and teaches fifth grade this year, who joins us now. Mrs. Kunkel, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John.
Last year it was looking for political indicators. This year it's all about economic indicators. What's changed in the sort of current affairs section of your curriculum this year?
Well, there's a lot less talk about, obviously, political issues as far as elections, and the kids put that one away really quickly. They don't talk as much about the economy as perhaps I expected they would.
Now, is that because there are troubling things going on at home, or it's just too complicated and boring?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. I think part of it is, though, that I don't think it has hit Boiling Springs as hard as it has hit some areas. And if it doesn't hit kids personally, I don't think they think about it that much.
Now, last year we really created a relationship with your class politically, and we sort of went at your students again and again to get their views of how the campaign was going. They were very, very involved in the campaign, very involved in trying to convince their parents to vote one way or another. How did that affect your class? Did it get in the way at all?
Not at all. In fact, it's kept a long-term relationship, probably a little more than I typically would have with those kids after they've moved on. I've had some of them get back to me, call back to me, come down and see me, and talk about the whole how things are going after the election and what they think back to and how they became so involved in it.
And Mrs. Kunkel, can you get us on the takeaway again?
Oh, absolutely.
So do some of the students actually bring economic troubles from home into the classroom from time to time?
Do you know, I have seen so little of that. Again, in our area, I think there's so little impact at this point to them specifically. I'd hear them talking about, you know, we're not doing this vacation this year or whatever it is, but I'm not even so sure they're always connecting that with the economic situation.
Well, here's a student from your class named Kelsey who called our line.
I think the economy is affecting me because we eat out less, we watch our electricity usage, and we have game nights so we don't have to spend a lot of money to have fun.
Now, there's an engaged child. Are fifth graders engaged in what's going on in the outside world, even when there's not an election campaign going on?
They are. They constantly, and a lot of it is kind of what their parents are talking about at home, and they tend to bring that to school, often bringing parents' viewpoints to school. And I think sometimes it's really even interesting to hear them go back and forth between each other, because it's probably like hearing their parents talking to each other.
Is this class a different focus group than last year's class, do you think?
Oh, tremendously.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Not nearly as politically involved. Now, this group did come into me when the election was taking place, so I would have thought they would have been very embroiled in it.
Well, it varies so much year to year. Well, stay with us. We want to talk about what kids are bringing to school that comes directly from the headlines. Janet Kunkel teaches fifth grade at Iron Forge in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. She'll be back with us in a moment.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Deciding what you're going to do in response to the swine flu outbreak is dependent upon how much trust you have in what the government is telling you about swine flu.
In all fairness, after billions doled out for big business with no accountability and very little done for the common person, I have very little confidence in our government. I would trust our government to deal with a Pez candy contamination crisis at this point, but not a global swine flu pandemic.
What's your level of trust at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Continuing the theme of swine flu, countries around the world have begun tightening their borders as the number of cases of swine flu rise. Keiji Fukuda of the World Health Organization says that every country needs to prepare for an outbreak.
There is no region to which this virus could not spread. And if we move into a pandemic situation, then by definition that means that all countries around the world would be at risk from pandemic influenza.
Right now, the United States is discouraging non-essential travel to Mexico. The Obama administration is taking steps to reverse a last-minute Bush-era rule that allows mountaintop mining waste to be dumped near streams. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is asking a federal court to abandon it, saying that the last-minute regulation was a bad policy. In international news, Pope Benedict is visiting Italy to meet victims of the earthquake that struck the region 3 weeks ago. He's actually visiting central Italy. More than 60,000 people are still homeless.
And for the first time in his 17 years on NBC's The Tonight Show, Jay Leno called in sick last week. Back at work last night, Leno talked about the nightmare he had in hospital.
You know, I spent the night, I was there 24 hours, and I had a horrible dream. I couldn't breathe. I felt like I was suffocating. Then I woke up and realized, oh, Conan was holding a pillow over my bed. I said, hey, who's that?
Who cares?
So,
who cares about him?
Conan O'Brien. Leno went to hospital with a fever of 103, and he seems to be back on form. All his comedy genes are intact.
He owns a pig farm, I get it. Thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
So kids bring things from home into their school, not just viruses. The question is, do the statements and sentiments that kids have about what's going on in the world become teachable moments, or do they become something deeper? Listen to Arun. He's an 11-year-old.
My father, he lost his job, but he got a new one. He works at BJ's. He used to work at Circuit City. Like, he was kind of just, like, emotional about losing his job. Kind of felt, like, sad and mad about the people who did this.
Sentiments, not statistics, about the economy coming from an 11-year-old in Brooklyn. Author and counselor Denise Daniels realized she was seeing more children and families coming for help because of the stresses of the recession, so she poured all her expertise into creating a free online journal with the education group, the publisher Scholastic. The result is What Can I Do?, a free online journal designed for children to work through their credit crunch anxiety. In Brooklyn, of course, there's one snapshot of the economy, but in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, where Janet Kunkel, a fifth-grade teacher at Iron Forge Elementary, joins us, there's another picture of the economy. Hello, Janet Kunkel.
You're welcome.
And Denise Daniels here in the studio. Thanks so much for joining
us.
Good morning. Denise, I'll begin with you. What's the difference between grief and sort of taking what happens at the dinner table at home and making it part of, say, a classroom curriculum?
Well, I think really if we're talking about the economy right now, people underestimate how emotional this is. I mean, we're talking about families losing their homes, kids losing their pets, parents losing jobs. The parents are stressed out trying to make ends meet, and kids are very intuitive and perceptive. And so they see their families grieving about that kind of loss and family transition. But yet so much attention has been focused on the parents that we're realizing that that kind of grief and loss reverberates through the entire family. And that's why it's so important to not overlook the children.
Well, I want to talk about strategies for dealing with some of the kids. But let's note that Arun, 11, from Brooklyn, is a student at Eugenio Maria de Hostos School. And pictures of the students at that school who participated in this segment are on our website. They're at Intermediate School 318. And also, you can hear the sound of students from Janet Kunkel's class. Here's Maya Brown talking about how the economy has affected her family.
Hi, this is Maya Brown calling from Mrs. Kunkel's class. How is the economy affecting you, and how is your family saving money during these tough times? The economy is affecting me because my mom is very close to losing her job, and it concerns me a whole lot. And we are trying to buy less junk that we really don't need and only getting the very most important things at the store to save a lot of money.
So, Janet Kunkel, were you surprised to learn that about your student, Maya?
Yes, in a way, but in another way not, because children come to school every day with different stresses from home, and some are very open about what the stress is, and others you just know that there is something that's bothering them. And so sometimes you're not surprised to find out that there is something, but you're just not necessarily aware of what it might be.
Well, Denise Daniels mentioning something that's close to the heart of an 11-year-old versus not mentioning it are two very, very different approaches, and you can really get it wrong. What advice do you have, Denise?
Well, absolutely. What I say with children is what's mentionable is manageable. Because children, if they don't have accurate, age-appropriate information, they're oftentimes very confused. Kids are intuitive. They're perceptive. They understand what's going on around them. They may not have information, but they can see their parents stressed out. They know that everybody's emotional. And so it's very important that we give them developmentally appropriate information so that they have a clear understanding of what's happening.
Or here's another 11-year-old. Her name is Anna.
My mom, she came home yesterday really stressed out. She said now that the recession is getting worse, her boss is much more strict, and she was really mad yesterday. She was really worried, and I was worried, too, that she would get laid off.
Now, Jenna Kunkel, when a student mentions something like that, is that a warning sign to you, or is it an indication, well, this kid is working through it and is managing a situation that probably is pretty stressful? We'll let her do it on her own.
I like to hear that they're talking about it because I feel like with them being ready to talk about it, I'm able to, on a more casual level than a counseling session, I'm able to kind of give them the pat on the back and say to them another day, you know, having a good day, not necessarily bringing up the exact topic. But I also find with kids at the age that I deal with that the more that they like the consistency of school, it's a safe place, they like that schedule to go on, they like to know that their world is kind of continuing.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Is part of the motivation, Denise, in creating the site, what can I do to create this safe place where parents and students can maybe learn about how to communicate more effectively?
Absolutely. And we have a parent's guide as well, and we thought that was really important. And the workbook is really a guide for parents, but it's also an interactive resource and tool that parents can use with their children. It really helps kids learn coping strategies. It helps them identify emotions. It teaches the difference between self-worth and net worth, which is really a neat skill that we want to teach our children, and values as well. Need versus want. It teaches wonderful delayed gratification, emotional intelligence skills. So we think it's really important to take this teachable moment and really give these kids coping skills that can last a lifetime.
And perhaps some of these kids, here's a Naja from Brooklyn. She's also an 11-year-old. Maybe they should be on some of the financial channels.
I think people should just relax because everybody's so like all over the place worrying about, oh, where my money's gonna go, oh, how am I gonna pay for this. I think everybody just needs to take a break, relax, and think about what you can do that doesn't cost a lot of money, and then maybe our economy would get better.
Often wisdom from 11-year-olds, right, Janet Kunkel?
I would say so.
Denise Daniels, do kids have as much advice to give as maybe to get in these tough times?
I think they do. If you listen to all of these kids, they're very much aware of what's going on. And I'm very much a proponent of having family meetings where once a week families get together and they talk about lifestyle changes or adjustments they need to make as a family. Kids, particularly the age of Maya students, really want to feel effective and empowered. Mm. They want to make a contribution. We've got kids saying, well, now instead of having our dog groomed, we wash our dog ourselves, or we pack our lunch at home instead of doing it at school. One of the kids earlier was talking about turning off lights. Someone's assigned in the family to turn off lights.
Right.
All of those are little things, but they become huge things in helping families cope.
And all wisdom. And you can see and hear all the little kids on this segment on our website with their wisdom. There's a link to Denise Daniels' online journal, What Can I Do? Denise is also the co-founder of the National Childhood Grief Institute. And Janet Kunkel, our friend at The Takeaway, who teaches fifth grade at Iron Forge in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. And we're also talking about swine flu. The outbreak has a lot of people worried and a lot of people with questions. Do you have trust in your government? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Carol writes, ridiculous question, but who else are we to trust? And she has a related story to tell from the 1918 flu pandemic. My grandfather was the ensign in charge of a sub chaser during World War I. When news of the flu outbreak broke, he canceled shore leave and ordered everyone on his little boat to wash their hands. I'm sure the crew thought he was a bastard, but he was no guy to mess around with. They washed their hands. He was lucky, but it was the only ship where no one got sick. He got a commendation from the Navy because of it. If you missed anything on the program, we're always on. Subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
A fifth grader's takeaway on the U.S. economy.
Hi, this is Natalie Bryce. I'm calling from Pennsylvania, Mrs. Kunkel's room. I was calling to answer the questions about the economy that are going to be on the Takeaway show. How is the economy affecting you? It is affecting me because
Someday I will probably have to pay off all the money that the government is spending.
Ooh, all by yourself? That's a lot of pressure. But the kids in Mrs. Kunkel's class in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, are used to it. Teachers teach history in the making and red letter days. Whose birthday is it today? How about The Takeaway?
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Yeah, we don't like to talk about our age, but it's Tuesday, April 28th, and we are 1 year old here at this program. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, the latest on the swine flu outbreak. We're going to talk about the possibility of developing a vaccine. A CBS New York Times poll finds that Americans are seeing a big difference in race relations 99 days into the Obama administration, and Paul Krugman on the first 100 days. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano is defending the U.S.'s so-called passive surveillance border monitoring policy between the U.S. and Mexico to stop the spread of swine flu. She says stronger measures aren't needed yet.
You have to look at what the costs of that are. We literally have thousands of trucks and lots of commerce that cross that border. We have food products and other things that have to go across that border.
So shutting it down, the secretary says, would be a heavy cost for little gain in terms of stopping the spread of the virus. She says the government is prepared in case the outbreak grows, however.
As you know, we already have the virus pretty widespread within the United States. So there's a lot of action that is going on to make sure, for example, the stockpile of antivirals is moving to the states that already have confirmed cases. That is underway.
50 reported cases in the U.S., limited to New York, California, Texas, Kansas, and Ohio. Femi Okeh is here to help me out. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there. John, Secretary Janet Napolitano is expected to testify before Congress tomorrow to update it on the swine flu situation. She's been busy with the outbreak because the Senate hasn't confirmed the country's next Secretary of Health and Human Services. A vote on the nomination of Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius is expected later this afternoon. Overseas, Pakistan is expanding its fight against the Taliban. The Pakistani military says that fighter jets are attacking military hideouts in a district near Islamabad. Ground troops are also preparing to enter the Bunair district, which is close to the Swat Valley. And a British jury has acquitted three men accused of helping with the July 2005 bombings on the London subway. The explosion killed 52 people. The men were originally tried in 2008, but the first jury failed to reach verdicts against them. John.
So Wall Street seems to be worried about a number of financial issues, including the swine flu outbreak. The Dow was mostly flat yesterday. The S&P went down 1% to finish at 858. Futures trading on Wall Street suggests a negative opening in about 30 minutes when Wall Street markets open. The outbreak of swine flu has a lot of people worried. Do you have trust in what your government is telling you? Give us your take at 8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
My name is Barbara. I'm in Shelby Township, Michigan, and I think I trust the government more than a lot of media people who hype it up and make it sound more alarming and worse than it is and generate more panic rather than trying to keep people calm and clear-headed.
One of our listeners trying to sort out the jumble of numbers and facts about the swine flu outbreaks. Joining us once again is Richard Wenzel, who is the Virginia Commonwealth University Chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine and an expert in infectious disease. He joins us from Richmond. Dr. Wenzel, responding to our listener, if you look at a map, what's the most important thing to pay attention to? The number of fatalities in a particular place or the speed and direction in which this virus is spreading?
I think two issues. One is we're at least in four continents in terms of how far the virus has spread. And secondly, I think the real key is what's going on in Mexico. Why are people dying there when it looks mild elsewhere? And I think what's really going to be important is to know what's the cause of death there. Is it the virus? Is it some secondary bacterial pneumonia?
Now, is this a problem with information coming out of Mexico, that possibly there are some bottlenecks in getting this information, or is there something unique about the specific setting for where these fatalities occurred?
Well, maybe both. As I look at it from a distance, I mean, we have the same virus attacking the same age group in both the United States and Mexico, and the difference is outcome is severe in Mexico. So it's got to be the patients. And then, do they have some unusual susceptibility? We're partially protected. I doubt it. Is it more likely that there's some secondary bacterial pneumonia? That's a possibility. The last might be, you know, Mexico City has horrible pollution. We know that. And pollution has been related to worse outcomes in other countries like England and Ireland and Scotland.
Now, one of the restraints on avian flu, apparently, in preventing it from being transmitted was that really people needed to be in contact with infected birds, and really, you know, it involved them actually being in the slaughterhouses in some cases. Is it possible that these fatalities in Mexico relate to some proximity to pigs that might increase the viral load and increase their susceptibility to death that wouldn't be the case, say, in, you know, New York?
I think it's unlikely because most of the people in the center of Mexico City, a huge urban metropolis with 20 million people, aren't living with pigs. Outside, I would say that's more likely. This is person-to-person spread of a pig virus that has elements of human and avian genes with it. So it's really not so much pig to man anymore.
Now, the Centers for Disease Control, echoing some of your sort of head-scratching, spoke yesterday on this issue of the difference between the spectrum in Mexico and here in the United States. Listen to what Dr. Richard Besser was saying, and then I want to get your response here.
Sure. That is a critical question. What we need to understand is why we're seeing a different disease spectrum in Mexico than we're seeing here. I wouldn't be overly reassured by that. There are many reasons that could explain that, And as we gather information, we hope to sort that out. I wouldn't rest on the fact that we have only seen cases in this country that are less severe. As we continue to look, I expect that we will see additional cases. I expect that the spectrum of disease will expand.
Dr. Wenzel, I mean, if that doesn't occur, if there aren't fatalities elsewhere, is it more of a mystery than actually getting to the bottom of how to treat this particular virus if it does spread and the fatalities do spread?
Well, if it turns out that all the disease is mild in the United States and, in fact, in New Zealand or Canada and in Europe, then we've got to focus on what's different about Mexico. Then it would say that there's something unusual there. It's either they, for some reason, they have secondary bacterial pneumonias at a huge rate, and that's always a difficult problem. Or maybe the damage to the airways locally there. I think the acting head of CDC was being cautious, but as the numbers expand and we continue to see mild cases, then we have to turn the focus back to what's different about the patients in Mexico.
Before we let you go, I want to ask you one question about the incubation of this virus. Do we know what the incubation time is, and how does that inform people like myself in figuring out what preventive measures to take should we think we possibly come in contact?
Well, usually with flu, it's 2 or 3 days, but up to a week. So beyond the week, you're safe after exposure to a particular person who's infected. So that's why President Obama is safe from his trip to Mexico. It's well over a week.
Oh, that's interesting. Dr. Richard Wenzel, thanks for joining us, Virginia Commonwealth University Chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine, who's been helping us to understand what's going on in these outbreaks around the world. Thanks so much, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
Joining us now is Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent for The New York Times, to talk about some very interesting numbers. Okay, so the rest of the media is focused on the first 100 days, but at least the first 99 days seem to have had a positive impact on race relations in the United States, as reported in The New York Times. It's a new New York Times CBS poll, and it reports that Americans, apparently, at least in their impressions, are seeing a big difference in race relations in the United States. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
How significant are these numbers, and are impressions of racial relations the same as actually an improvement in relations?
Well, I think that's a good question. This is it's hard to document an actual improvement in race relations,
right.
But you can document what people feel about it, and these numbers are significant. Two-thirds of Americans now say that race relations are generally good. That's up from 53% in July of 2008 when President Obama was still Senator Obama and running for office. And even more startling is the percentage of blacks who say that race relations are generally good. The percentage of blacks who say that is now 59%, double what it was in July of 2008 when it was 29%.
Now, during the campaign, there was a lot of polling on the question of, is America ready for an African-American president? And there were differences among racial groups as to what people believed. In a sense, Barack Obama being president eliminates that question. Does that affect the sort of, grid by which people assess race relations, because that milestone has really been taken away?
Well, I think it's hard to know why people feel this, but we did try to tease that out by doing some interviews after the poll. And what came out consistently in the interviews was that people feel that the president is helping people work together or fostering a climate in which people are working together. And they also feel that race relations were improving in the United States anyway, but that President Obama seems to be speeding that along. One woman said that in her small town, this is a white homemaker, a Republican, in Kansas City, and she said that his openness and acceptance have helped others be more open and accepting. So it may also be a matter of personal style.
How do these impressions break down black to white? And I don't know if you polled Hispanics. I'm just looking at the numbers now. And how do they break down Republican-Democrat?
Well, we don't have those kind of specific breakdowns. I gave you the breakouts that our polling folks shared with me, and the black and white, you can see that blacks obviously feel that a greater leap has been made. While two-thirds of whites say that race relations are generally good, the movement has been greater among blacks, from 29% to 59%. And interestingly, in this poll shows that black Americans remain among the president's staunchest supporters. 70% of black respondents now say the country is headed in the right direction. That's double the 34% of whites who say the country is headed in the right direction. So blacks, of course, are very enthusiastic about President Obama.
But is that to say that given the economy and other issues that are going on, that it's a minority of whites who believe the country is moving in the right direction?
Well, I suppose you could say it's a minority of whites, but let's think about the number of Americans who thought the country was moving in the right direction back in January, when the president was inaugurated. Overall, I think that number was something like 15% right
wow.
direction. Now, overall, it's 41%. That's a huge shift. The first time in probably 4 years at least that Americans are starting to think that the country is moving in the right direction, that the right track, wrong track numbers are kind of reversing with people now beginning to see that things are going the right way.
And that's almost a tripling.
Yeah.
And that is independent of race, probably. I mean, that relates to a whole variety of things going on in both the administration and the economy.
Right. Well, it's interesting. We also looked at what Americans think the president can accomplish. And Americans actually have very high hopes for Barack Obama. 72% said they were optimistic about the next 4 years. They expect him to make significant progress in health care, energy, and immigration policy. Yet, interestingly, the feeling of optimism is kind of tempered, if you would say, by a feeling that the economy and the war in Iraq really won't turn around in the president's first term.
But still probably a pretty good read for the president. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, White House correspondent for The New York Times, with some positive polling for President Obama related to his first 99 days in the White House.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm willing to bet that whether you're cynical about the government or whether you trust the government, that will really determine how you respond when they tell you about swine flu outbreaks.
Hi, this is Chris from White Lake, Michigan. I trusted the government with my 401k and with my retirement. Why wouldn't I trust them with my health? Oh, wait a minute. I've lost my 401k and my retirement. Holy crap.
Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Joining us now is Randy Cohen. He's the author of the Ethicist column in the New York Times Magazine and a new blog on the Times website called The Moral of the Story. Randy, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, John.
My first question to you, and you know, forgive me for digressing, is it ethical for someone who lives in New York to not drag himself down to the studio to be a guest on The Takeaway?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It is. Oh.
Anytime it involves the words drag themselves down, you can be pretty sure the answer is you're not obliged.
Well, the reason we're talking to you, Randy, is because one of the things I like about your column is that it takes a story from the headlines and really sort of probes into a moral dimension, which actually has the possibility of revealing more about the news than we might have gotten just looking at the story straight. The Bernard Madoff story, right?
Yes.
Now, of course, Bernard Madoff is awaiting sentencing for the so-called $65 billion Ponzi scheme, which bilked all kinds of investors out of money. There was no investment fund that Bernard Madoff had, even though he was very, very wealthy, correct?
Yes.
Now, all along with him, faithfully, was his wife, Ruth Madoff, correct?
That's right.
So the question is, if you're an investor who lost money in the Madoff fortune, do you have any claim against Ruth Madoff, civilly or criminally, to get your money back? Because she must have known, right?
Well, first of all, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't purport to give legal advice. But as I understand it, if what she has is ill-gotten gains, then yes, you have a claim on it. If it's money she's made in some other way, then you don't. But did she know? We don't know if she knew. That is something a court will determine. But from my perspective, the ethical question is, should she have known? And can you ask that of people? Can you say, well, you should have known? Is that a legitimate moral question?
Well, of course, in all the like mob movies from the 1930s, you know, there's this principle of the wife can't testify against the husband, that there's no, the state can't compel a wife to testify against a spouse. But I guess, does that mean that in our jurisprudence, there is a notion that it is perfectly ethical to keep secrets within a marriage vow?
Well, that assumption of the law is the opposite. The assumption of the law is that spouses disclose themselves to one another. They reveal themselves to one another. And the bonds of marriage are something we respect so much that we would not force one spouse to testify against another. But that's also a question about what you should do with that knowledge. Once you know something, your spouse has done something very, very wicked, what must you do? But the first question for me is, must you know? When you live intimately with someone like this, and more important in the Ruth Madoff case, when you are profiting and enormously, you know, once you're buying your third house, the one in Palm Beach, or your fourth house, the one in Antibes, should you ask yourself at some point, where is this money coming from that rains down upon me?
All right, so ask me.
Where is this money coming from that rains down upon you?
Honey, we're just having a great year.
Okay, that's fine. And I notice you seem to be having a great year every year.
I've had a lot of great years. See how hard it is?
If your spouse is determined to fool you, everyone can be fooled, but you can't persist in willful ignorance. You have to at least attempt to know. And near as I can tell, Ruth Madoff is not a schnook.
But does she have to be a schnook? I mean, is she required morally for her to take out a spreadsheet and kind of reverse engineer the trends?
But nor is it allowable for her to simply close her eyes to what seems obvious to her, to go through life never wondering, oh, this money we're enjoying, Miss Scarlett. You know, I've noticed our cotton seems to be picked by slaves. Did you ever notice that? I mean, she's an adult. She's not a 4-year-old.
Well, slavery was legal. Slavery was legal in Georgia.
I don't write the legalist. I write the moralist.
Right.
Slavery may have been legal for much of our history, but it was never moral.
I'm not certainly saying that it was moral, But what I am saying is if the SEC couldn't figure out what was going on with Madoff, why would you expect
The level of knowledge she's required to attempt to have is not sufficient to bring a case in a court. Just to have some sense of where her enormous wealth that she's been enjoying for 50 years is coming from. Also, she is not the unsophisticated person you present her to be. She actually worked at her husband's company for a while. She steered clients to her husband. With that comes some obligations to have some understanding of how this all works.
Even if you give, say, $20 million to some charity?
That doesn't get you off the hook for how you acquired the $20 million.
You sure?
Morally? Absolutely not. That if I go and come over to your house and steal your TV, you know, my giving $10 to a charity when I sell it doesn't get me off the hook for robbing you. You have to judge each of those actions on their merit.
But isn't it karmic? Okay, if you give $20 million to some charity, all right, that makes up for the fact that, okay, there's been some pain here for some investors who lost money.
Are you saying that this is a judgment God has to decide in the fullness of things?
We're talking to the right guy here.
Not to me. Have your good deeds outweighed your bad deeds? That's a different way to look at morality than I do. To me, the question is, each deed must be judged on its own merits, and that if it's wrong to kill a guy, it's wrong to kill a guy, even if you use your hefty killer's fee to help some puppies later on.
All right, Randy, thanks so much. Randy Cohen is the author of the Ethicist column in the New York Times Magazine and a new blog on the Times website called The Moral of the Story, focusing on Ruth Madoff. Is there a moral issue with her observations of how Bernie was making all of his money? Thank you, Randy. And I have to say, we make a great couple. I think a really, really terrific couple, and we're going to have to reenact that one of these days. Femi Oke now has some headlines.
Good morning. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. The United Nations is trying to find out if industrial pig farms in Mexico are the source of the swine flu outbreak that's made thousands of people.
Still 29 minutes past the hour.
It's still. I think if I read it six more times, that the sentence will actually get better and better.
I'd help us to understand the swine flu story.
Absolutely. Yeah. People are in hospital in Mexico suffering from swine flu. I should just do it that way.
There you go.
Now, there aren't any confirmed pig cases in the US, but Iowa pig farmer Amy Wilkinson says that she's vigilantly checking her animals. And health experts say that the flu can't be transmitted directly from pigs to humans and that it's okay to eat properly handled pork. And that's one of the questions that we got yesterday, John, on the air as we were actually trying to explain what swine flu actually is. Going overseas now, a British jury has acquitted the three men accused of helping bombers attack a London subway in July 2005. The attack killed 52 people. The bombers blew themselves up on three subway trains and a bus. The acquitted men were originally tried in 2008, but the jury failed to reach a verdict. And that's your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. A little after lunchtime today in Washington, D.C., the foremost, probably the foremost expert on infectious disease in the world will sit down to testify before the Senate Agricultural Subcommittee's emergency hearing on swine flu. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Of course, he's been on the front line of infectious disease research and prevention since the 1980s. And before we get a crack at him here at The Takeaway, before his hearing later on today, today. Dr. Fauci, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
It's great to talk to you again, and I have so many questions, but the first one is from one of our listeners who asked, he hasn't heard from officials in all of the coverage so far what the incubation period for this strain of the flu is. What do we know at this point, Dr. Fauci?
Well, it's about 5 to 7 days from the time that you get exposed to the time that you actually manifest symptoms. So that's about general. It's maybe a day or so longer than the usual seasonal influenza incubation, not substantially different. So it's around the right ballpark for the incubation period.
How does that complicate or render moot some of the talk about quarantine or border closings or monitorings of populations going from point A to point B?
Well, you know, I think we have to be careful about the use of the word quarantine, because that sometimes triggers some unnecessary alarm. What is going on right now is, first of all, it is spread in a number of countries. You don't want people, you know, who are ill to be traveling. So the kinds of travel issues that are coming up is that people in a what we call a passive way will be asked, are you sick? Are you feeling ill? Or do you have a fever? If you do, you should see a physician and not travel at this time, going either way. But we stay away from the word quarantine and absolute restrictions, because we're not there yet, like may not ever get there. Mm-hmm. And it sometimes triggers unnecessary alarm in people.
So in 1918, of course, the flu catastrophe, which resulted in the deaths of millions of people around the world, there were very few tools in the medical toolbox for responding to the flu. Now we have a flu vaccine, at least a seasonal flu vaccine, not for this strain. But we also have antiviral drugs. And in the worst case scenario, if people are dying of flu, we have immunosuppressant drugs that actually help to mitigate the effects of their own immune system, which sometimes cause the fatalities. Which of those three is most important? And I may be missing some.
Well, actually, there are a few things that are important. Not only do we have antivirals, and I might point out that the circulating swine flu that we're talking about this morning is sensitive to the two major antiviral drugs that we have in the strategic national stockpile, Tamiflu and Relenza. So that's the first thing. The other thing is we also have antibiotics against some of the secondary complicating pneumonias that killed so many people in 1918. We didn't have antibiotics then. So, I mean, if the virus itself can give you a severe pneumonia, but there have been many complicating bacterial pneumonias. But also we have the kinds of intensive care for people who get very, very ill. The issue that's important, and I think people need to understand that we also have things that they had back then in 1918 that sometimes they didn't use as much as they should have, and that's community mitigation procedures, namely getting people to avoid crowded places, appropriately closing schools when it's necessary, when people are sick, keeping them at home and not going to places where they can infect others. All of that is low tech that was available then. But if you look historically back in 1918, we didn't always use that efficiently. We've learned lessons historically. So we have things from technical issues like better capability of taking care of people. We have antivirals. We have antibiotics against complications. But we also have a very good pandemic preparedness plan that, unfortunately, back then, historically, we didn't have, because we've been planning for this for a few years, associated with the threat of bird flu that you're familiar with in Southeast Asia, the H5N1. This is very different from that, but the preparations that we put in and are continuing to do for the bird flu apply very, very well to this swine flu today.
Well, we have a question from one of our listeners, Dr. Fauci. Listen to this and then respond, if you would.
This is Steve Armstrong. Just calling in because I was interested about the virulence of that swine flu, exactly what the threat is to us, especially out here in West Jordan, Utah.
That's a very good question. And the issue is, of the cases, at least 40 confirmed in the United States, the disease has generally not been serious. I never like to call influenza mild, but it, relatively speaking, it's been mild. There's been one hospitalization and no deaths. One of the things that still is not entirely clear is what the situation is going on in Mexico, because Mexico has over 1,500 cases and reported anywhere between 50 and 100 deaths. Mm-hmm.
whether all of them are due to the swine flu. Certainly some of them are. And the question is there anything different about the situation in Mexico, about what's going on with the infection in Mexico? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is very, very actively working with the authorities, the health authorities in Mexico, to determine that.
All right, Dr. Fauci, our last question. I hope it's not too technical, but someone you know very well on this program, Lori Garrett, suggested yesterday that large-scale agricultural techniques possibly contribute to the development of these kinds of viruses in some way. And I'm wondering if the reason for that, if you even agree, has to do with large-scale pig farms or bird farms or those kinds of farms that produce livestock, you know, will permit a virus to mutate and iterate more quickly, and that there's a greater likelihood that we would stumble on a virus that's really, really, you know, dangerous and potentially fatal. True or false?
Well, you know, I think fundamentally she has the correct principle there, is that when you have the commingling of birds, particularly avian birds, ducks, pigs, and humans, the way we see very frequently in Southeast Asia, you can have co-infection with human viruses, pig viruses, and bird viruses. And in fact, that's exactly what this swine flu is. It's called a triple resort. Namely, it has viral genes from multiple species, including humans, pigs, and birds. So what Lori says is essentially correct.
All right. Any preview of what you're going to tell the Agricultural Subcommittee this afternoon?
Well, you know, a lot about what we're talking about on the show right now. They're going to ask some fundamental questions. They are our legislators. They certainly have the right and the responsibility to know what's going on, and I'm going to try to inform them as best I can.
My guest, Dr. Anthony Fauci, is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He will be testifying before the Senate Agricultural Subcommittee's emergency hearing on swine flu this afternoon. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. I have some new figures about home prices. In major cities across the country, home prices dropped more than 18% in February. But there is some good news from the latest Case-Shiller Index. For the first time in 16 months, the drop in home prices wasn't a record. The World Health Organization says that it's no longer possible to contain the swine flu outbreak. Flu researcher John McCauley says that countries need to prepare for the virus to spread quickly. In Mexico, swine flu is suspected in at least 150 deaths, and new cases have been confirmed in Asia and the Middle East. And Sri Lanka has denied entry to a Swedish foreign minister who was supposed to take part in an humanitarian mission there. The United Nations and other groups have asked Sri Lanka to call for a ceasefire so that civilians trapped by fighting from the Tamil Tiger rebels can escape. That's your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. And you know, if you've talked with as many people as we have here on The Takeaway over the last year of being on the air, you can check in with folks who are friends and also have interesting insights who represent turning points. And we did have a presidential campaign for most of our first year on the air. And Peggy Silva is one of the citizens who spoke with us on The Takeaway and who actually represented a moment that was possibly a real turning point in the presidential campaign. Do you remember when Tom Brokaw asked John McCain and Senator Barack Obama this question back in Nashville, Tennessee?
And you'll both be interested to know, this comes from the internet, and it's from a state that you're strongly contesting, both of you. It's from Peggy in Amherst, New Hampshire. It has a certain zen-like quality. I'll give you a fair warning. She says, what don't you know, and how will you learn it?
Senator Obama got the first crack at that question, and she's our Yoda here on The Takeaway. Peggy Silva joins us now from Amherst, New Hampshire. Peggy, good morning.
Hi, good morning, John.
So that was a great moment. We didn't hear your voice, but we certainly heard your spirit in that question. What don't you know and how will you learn it? Do you remember Senator Obama's answer?
Yes, he usually refers to, he referred to the fact that Michelle usually handles that for him. You know, it wasn't a terribly thoughtful question, but my purpose in it is just to cut through and not ask something canned. Something that's been asked a lot before. So it wasn't the answer. It was really just the opportunity to ask a question that was a little bit different that really tickled me.
Well, it was not only a little bit different, but it turned out to be staggeringly relevant. You know why?
Why?
Because nobody in that debate asked about bank bailouts. Do you remember that?
Absolutely.
So therefore, he had to learn a lot of what he didn't know in the first 100 days. How do you think he did?
I think he's doing really well. I think that if I were to ask the question again today, I would ask him pretty much the same question, but it would be more empathetically worded. It would be, so now, what didn't you know, and how are you learning it? I have a lot of respect for the way he's learning it.
You know, Peggy, I have a feeling he might just say this one more time.
My wife, Michelle, is there, and she could give you a much longer list than I do. And most of the time, I learn it by asking her. But look, the nature of the challenges that we're going to face are immense. And one of the things that we know about the presidency is that it's never the challenges that you expect. It's the challenges that you don't that end up consuming most of your time.
Peggy, isn't that kind of spooky to hear him say that?
It is, because I think that he had the wisdom to know that he wouldn't know a lot of the challenges that he'd be facing.
But you know, when he said that, when I heard him say that during the debate, I thought, oh, there's a canned answer. It was prophetic, though.
I know.
So how you doing? Are you known as like the Zen lady of Amherst, New Hampshire these days?
It was no, nobody would ever call me Zen. I'm chaotic and very giggly, but I've never had a Zen moment. But it was very, very fun to be caught up in a media frenzy for about 2 or 3 days after. Actually, I still get about 3 or 4 contacts a week based on the October debate. It's been very fun.
And now she's back to writing and literacy coordinator at Sauhegan High School in Amherst, New Hampshire. Thanks for being part of our first year on the air, Peggy.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for including me, John. It's been an honor.
Take care, Peggy Silva.
Bye.
No different, only different in your mind.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Coming up, Paul Krugman on Barack Obama's first century of days, that is, when we have some headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour, almost. The threat of swine flu has prompted the FDA to approve emergency rules for certain antiviral drugs. Doctors will be able to use the drugs Tamiflu and Relenza for a wider range of the population in case mass treatment is needed. Treatment has to start, though, within the first 48 hours of the symptoms to be effective. In about 10 minutes from now, the Senate will convene and begin debating on whether to approve Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius as the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. A vote is expected to take place this afternoon. Judges in Scotland are hearing a new appeal from the Libyan intelligence officer convicted of blowing up an American jet over the town of Lockerbie in Scotland. That was back in 1988. 270 people were killed in the bombing, and the man was sentenced to life in prison but has always maintained his innocence. And that's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning, John.
Thank you, Femi. Joining us is Paul Krugman, columnist at our partner, The New York Times, Princeton University Economics and International Affairs professor, and the winner of the Nobel Prize. This week marks the 100th day of the Obama administration, kind of a century of days, we called it there. Paul, any advice for Barack Obama in his next 100 days?
Yeah, I think he's got to be more vigorous about dealing with the economy. I mean, I understand that there are political constraints, but he really hasn't made the case to the public for why we really need almost certainly a bigger stimulus bill, why we need to spend a lot of money on fixing the banks. I mean, they're trying right now to make it to go with almost no additional resources, and it's not enough. I mean, basically, he's running the risk of having his agenda, of which I support very much, undermined by a really disappointing economy, and he's got to get this thing moving.
Let's take apart those two pieces. One is the stimulus package, and I'm struck by the lack of huge ideas in the stimulus package. I'm reminded of the FDR period in the 1930s when LBJ went at FDR with a rusty rake and said, I want funding for rural electrification. I want funding for rural electrification. And that crazy idea became the basis for a transformative moment in American history that they spent a lot of money on, changed America politically and economically. But those kinds of ideas aren't in this stimulus, and I'm wondering why.
Well, I'm 80% sympathetic to the administration on this because you do want this to hit fast. I mean, remember, we have an economy that is contracting rapidly as we speak. We're losing 600,000 jobs a month. Projects that won't really get going for 3 years are not, unfortunately, going to do very much to address the clear and present danger. And the trouble with really big ideas is, by and large, they take a long time to get going. So it was inevitable that the stimulus would focus a lot on very conventional stuff, on basically filling potholes. That said, yeah, there should be more of that, partly because we need stuff, partly because all indications are that this crisis is going to go on for quite a while and stimulus that comes late will not be wasted, and partly, I think, just for inspiration. I'm supposed to be a hard-headed economist here, but I think there's been a notable lack of inspiration about the whole economic recovery package. It's been too much. We haven't had those great soaring speeches, which we know that the president can do so well, about really rebuilding America.
Intuitively, as Americans look abroad, and of course everybody remembers a year ago the Chinese Olympics and the sparkling cities of China that we saw there, why is it that cities in Asia seem so sparkling and futuristic, and cities in the United States, even Chicago and New York, seem, you know, more of a throwback, less concerned with the kinds of changes and building that, you know, you would think America would be concerned about with a stimulus package this large?
Yeah, well, we have in this country been starving public investment for almost 30 years now. Ever since Ronald Reagan declared that government is the problem, not the solution, there's been a steady nickel and diming down of the infrastructure projects that contribute so much to that sparkling feel of Asian cities. Now, that doesn't mean that every project you can think of ought to be approved, but we really haven't kept up. We've been doing bits and pieces. We've been basically avoiding collapse in our infrastructure. Sure, I mean, where is the visionary side? Where is the we're going to build the city of tomorrow? There's been none of that really in the United States under any president for a generation now. And I guess a lot of people had hoped for more of that from Barack Obama.
But you're scaring me now. You suggest that even with this stimulus package in place and the kinds of numbers that they're batting around in Washington, you don't seeing it reverse the trends that were begun under Ronald Reagan.
No, remember, we're talking about a stimulus bill that at its maximum will spend about 2.5% of gross domestic product. And a lot of that won't be infrastructure. A lot of that will be simply aid to state and local governments as a way of helping them avoid cuts in spending. Some of it will be in the form of tax cuts. You know, this is not anything remotely on the scale of Roosevelt's WPA. And, of course, even that wasn't enough to really decisively end the Great Depression. So you have to have some perspective here, right? $800 billion sounds like one heck of a stimulus bill. But
sure does.
In a $15 trillion economy with that spending spread over 3 years, it doesn't look so large when all is said and done.
Well, let's talk about the banks then. When you said that the Obama administration can be criticized for attempting to save the banks, and I think I'm quoting you correctly here, with essentially no additional resources, as you look at the bank bailout, you don't see additional resources brought to bear here, that they're attempting to do this with cash on hand?
Well, it's a little bit funny. What they're doing is they're taking what's left of the TARP, that original $700 billion pot of money that was approved under the previous administration, and they're trying to leverage that up through some fancy footwork. They're going to invite in private participation. They're going to get the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, stepping way outside its normal role, to guarantee a bunch of debts. So strictly speaking, yeah, they are actually going to put taxpayers on the hook for a substantial amount of money if the plan gets going, which is itself in question. But they're not going back to Congress and saying, okay, look, this wasn't done right, it wasn't sufficient. Here's our plan to fix the banking system. We know you guys are going to hate this, but it's going to require that you pass a bill authorizing us to spend another $700 billion or something like that. Instead, they're saying, well, we're going to take the residual authority that we have from a bill that was passed way back in October of 2008,
right,
and we're going to leverage that up by taking a very generous interpretation of what the FDIC is already supposed to do, and we're not going to go back to Congress for anything more. It would be surprising, given the depth of the problem, if that kind of doing it on the cheap approach was going to be enough, and I don't think it will be.
So doing it on the cheap in cost terms, but also doing it on the cheap in terms of political courage, do you think the Obama administration is intimidated by Congress, doesn't want to go to Congress, doesn't want to do the work that's required to get the consensus to come up with these big numbers?
They certainly haven't tried. I mean, the whole modus operandi of the administration has been to guess what they think they can get through Congress and ask for that and no more. And there's been no attempt to push the envelope, no attempt to get more. So the stimulus bill was designed to pass Congress. I think they were surprised to discover that they weren't getting any Republican support anyway, even though I think their own economists, I don't know this for sure, but I'm sure their own economists said this really doesn't look big enough. And they've done nothing in terms of asking for bank authority. So, yeah, the whole approach really has been one of what Bush used to call negotiating with yourself, right? They start by saying what they think they can get, and then they say, well, let's ask for a bit less than that, and never gets to the point of them actually pushing. And I'm sure that Rahm Emanuel would say, I'm just naive, and I don't understand that this really can't be done. But it's been striking that Obama, who certainly looks like the great persuader, hasn't really tried to do very much persuading on these issues.
So your advice for the next 100 days would be, why don't we have the first 100 days?
To some extent, yeah.
Now I'm crying.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's look, lots of things have happened. The stimulus bill is a whole lot better than not, right? This is immensely better than what might have happened under a McCain-Palin administration. There has been a significant increase in confidence. I mean, you don't want to dismiss that. People are feeling a lot better about the direction of the country because they feel that we have good people in charge. All of that's to the good, but it hasn't been the blizzard of real change that a lot of the president's supporters were hoping was going to happen.
Paul Krugman, Princeton University economics and international affairs professor, Nobel Prize winner, author of The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008. He's a columnist at our partner, The New York Times. The outbreak of swine flu has a lot of people worried and shaken with their confidence, a lot of people with questions. We want to know, are you hearing what you need from your government? And do you have trust in what your government is telling you?
This is Maggie from Yonkers regarding your question about whether we trust the government. I happen to know that there are approximately 8 cases of swine flu in Westchester, some of them being in White Plains Hospital, but we haven't heard anything on the news about that, so I'm just wondering.
Your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. With 152 deaths in Mexico but only 50 non-fatal cases in the U.S., here's your swine flu takeaway.
But as the numbers expand and we continue to see mild cases, then we have to turn the focus back to what's different about the patients in Mexico.
Dr. Richard Wenzel, Virginia Commonwealth University, talking about infectious disease and swine flu. I'm John Huckenberry. This is the one-year anniversary of The Takeaway.
Welcome to Happy Hour.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.